Okay, one of the topics in the Daf Yomi this week, really both a topic explicitly in the Daf this week and also less explicitly, but brought up by the Rishonim as to why it's not a topic, where it seems like it should be a topic, is the issue of Mitzvah L'Kayim Divrei HaMeis. And what exactly that means, and how exactly to interpret the word mitzvah, what exactly is its scope and its impact and its practical effect, b'zman hazeh as well, is a major discussion, and we won't try to paskin halacha l'maaseh, but just to say a few words about what exactly its impact is and what are its possible underpinnings and what might its parameters involve. So the Gemara does tell us that this concept exists on the Daf Yudalid in Gittin, following a Mishnah which talks about a instruction that someone gives to dispense money after he dies and doesn't base it on that, and therefore the Rishonim bring up why that's not the basis of that Mishnah, and then the sugya appears a little bit later. So this concept, first of all, just as far as where it comes from, so many assume that this is a din derabanan, whatever the din is, but many assume it's a din derabanan. There's a Tosfos Maseches Ksubos seems to say that beferish. The Note of Yehuda has a tshuva where he takes it for granted that it is a din derabanan. But there are those who try to find a source min haTorah. The Sho'el of Eshuv and a number of tshuvas quotes the drashas of the Ma'ariv and Schwab, who quotes from a Ramban, that the Ramban thought that it can be derived from Sefer Bereishis, from Parshas Vayechi, where we find that Yaakov gives the instruction to Yosef that he shouldn't be buried in Mitzrayim, and that Yosef carries out this instruction, and that maybe that's the source for the notion of Mitzvah L'Kayim Divrei HaMeis. He himself, the Sho'el HaMeishiv, questions that as a source, because it's not necessarily clear from that is the motivating factor. There was a notion of Kibbutz Eim involved there, something we'll come back to, and there are other aspects of that story, and maybe it's not necessary. Maybe we can understand intuitively that there is such a concept, just as a reflection of the general midah of Yashrus. And that's also a concept that shows up in Parshas Vayechi, Asisa Imadi Chesed Emes, the notion that there is a special chesed involved in fulfilling the wishes of Emes, and that it's something that, all other things being equal, is considered to be appropriate and a reflection of the sincerest desires of an individual when possible. So certainly as a Musar value, it is something that we can relate to. So as a binding chiyuv, though, so that's where it gets a little bit more mysterious and a little bit more murky, and subject to a discussion among Rishonim and Achronim as to what exactly it tells us. So, first of all, it seems like it's mostly relevant in monetary contexts. And Tashvetz, for example, writes that it's hard to understand why there should be a mitzvah l'kayim divrei hames. Is it that the mace, all of a sudden, when a person dies, he becomes a king, or he becomes a magician, he becomes some kind of a lord, that he all of a sudden has powers that he didn't have when he's alive? So if he doesn't have authority when he's alive, why does he all of a sudden get authority now that he dies? Where does that authority come from? It's hard to understand. It's funny, it has a little bit of an overlap of the theme in this week's parsha. In this week's parsha, we learn about Tumas Nazir, and there's an exception. And a Nazir, unlike a Kohen, a Nazir is not Metame even for a relative, but he is Metame for a Meis Mitzvah, which is one of the sources for the obligation of Kavod HaBrios. And Schechter often points out that we learn out Kavod HaBrios as a Kal V'chomer from Kavod HaMeis. People have a misunderstanding that they think that Kavod HaMeis is some kind of a new concept, that when a person's alive, you can treat him terribly and you can do whatever you want to him, and then all of a sudden when he dies, Kavod HaMeis, now you have to all of a sudden start respecting him. It's really the opposite. It's a Kal V'chomer that if you have to be respectful to somebody when he's not alive to be aware of how he's being treated, all the more so, Kal V'chomer, you should be respectful of people when they're alive. So, as the Tashbetz is indicating, so if a person doesn't have authority when he's alive, so how is he all of a sudden going to get authority when he's dead? So what do you mean to say Mitzvah L'Kayim Divrei HaMeis? So, Memela, or presumably, what it means is that we're talking specifically about the dispensing of his property, something where he would have had authority when he's alive. And that this is an aspect of the mitzvah of nachlos, that this is something connected to that general idea. And that's an important concept that they'll come back to, because we'll try to discuss a little bit, time permitting, how this connects to inheritance in general, and what connection this has to wills. And the whole discussion that comes up nowadays is a very important question as to the notion of a halachic will and what is the validity of civil wills. If somebody writes a will and dictates what he would like to happen with his property, so we know the Torah has a plan for one's property. After one dies, normally the property passes on to the male children, with a double portion going to the oldest, and only going to the daughters if there are no sons, etc., etc. And nowadays there is generally a practice of writing wills, halachic wills, that allow for distribution in alternative methods. And there's a major debate whether a civil will has validity as well. So without trying to paskin any of those issues, so a question that can be asked, and we'll try to look at it a little bit, is there any effectiveness to a civil will because of the principle of mitzvah l'kayim divrei hameis? And even if we assume that there isn't, and let's say we work with a halachic will specifically, we don't have time necessarily to explain exactly how a halachic will works, that's for a different time, but if we were to utilize a halachic will, which is highly recommended by Poskim, but one could ask, is that not a subversion of the intent of the Torah? If the Torah has a plan for how property is supposed to be distributed, so why is it proper, as far as the intent of the Torah, to make any other kind of a plan? So it's worth considering if there's a moral weight to mitzvah l'kayim divrei hameis, so how does that work together with whatever the intent of the Torah is? So this Tashbetz is particularly noteworthy, because if he's suggesting that not only is there a moral value to mitzvah l'kayim divrei hameis, so that's something to also take in parallel with the mitzvah of nachlos, but he's understanding it as part of the mitzvah of nachlos. He's understanding that the Torah has this parsha also factoring in what the desire of the owner of the property is. So the notion that mitzvah l'kayim is supposed to work in tandem with that is also perhaps relevant to understanding how there could be a place for anyone to dictate what should happen with his property after he dies, and that's perhaps something to consider as well. But it is certainly assumed that this is not a power that extends beyond one's property in general. So that's the Noda Behuda that I mentioned before, where he says that he assumes it's a din drabanan. So he mentions that in a kind of a dismissive context, that it's not going to override other things. So he was talking about a case where a man, before he died, he gave an instruction about one of his family members who they should or shouldn't be allowed to marry, when his daughter shouldn't be allowed to marry someone. So that's also a power that he wouldn't have had when he's alive. We assume that a parent cannot instruct a child who to marry under most circumstances. That's its own discussion. But he says, certainly if a parent wouldn't have that authority when he's alive, so he certainly doesn't have that authority after he's no longer alive. And it's in that context, no, the Behuda says, certainly not for Adin Drabanan. And the Shlis Yaakov has a tshuva along similar lines, where he talks about a family dispute where a parent had said they wanted to be dealt with in a certain way after they died, and they made the children shake on it. And so that was also considered not to be binding, because it wasn't about the property per se, although in that case, because there was a shaking on it, there was an agreement, maybe that was done just so that the parents shouldn't get upset, but still there was an agreement. We thought there was a moral value to going through with it anyway, but it wasn't necessarily an imperative in terms of mitzvah l'kayim divrei hameis. So as far as it goes regarding the property, so there was a significant machlokas rishonim, and somewhat of a question had a paskin, that one reason that it may not necessarily be sufficient to account for the validity of a will is that many Rishonim assume, but not all the Rishonim, but many Rishonim assume that it's only valid if there is a escrow, that if it's hushlush, that the individual who wants to have his property divided based on his instructions has to actually give that property to a third party, put it into escrow, and then that person is holding on to it after the original owner passes away, so then he has an obligation to distribute the property per that instruction. But if it wasn't hushlush, So then that wouldn't necessarily be the case. Other Rishonim didn't have that requirement, and some suggested that it's not really a machlokis, it all depends on who the person would be who ends up holding it. That if it's a inheritor who ends up holding it, so then that person has the control to do with it what he wants to, so then he should have the obligation to follow the instruction of the parent. Just the question is it going to be in the hands of somebody who has the power to do with it what the original owner wants to? So that was a discussion in the Rishonim. It's a little bit of a question how to paskin. And that's a continuing issue, and that's part of the reason why it's not clear if that would be enough to explain that, explain the validity of a will. This is presumably different, according to most Rishonim, from the concept of a Shchiv Meira. That when it comes to a Shchiv Meira is a special takana of Chazal, that Chazal were concerned that a person who is in the process of dying, person who is in a fatal illness, terminal illness, so we don't want to cause them any further stress beyond what they're already dealing with. So Chazal made an institution that when they declare that their property should go to somebody, that there isn't a need for a kinyan beyond that. That is considered to be signed, sealed, and delivered. And that is connected specifically to the fact that it is basically a deathbed declaration. So it is dependent on the reality that the individual is sick. And if he recovers from that illness, so then it's canceled. While this is presumably, according to most Rishonim, there are some who are connected to that, but the majority view is that this is a different concept, that this is not connected to a person being ill necessarily. A person can make this declaration when they're alive, and it's not subject to these same requirements. It's not going to be, since it's not dependent on an illness, it's not going to be canceled by any kind of a recovery, but it may have this extra requirement that it may need to be put into escrow by person during their lifetime. So that was a question, and it was a question then, does this create any kind of a kinyan? That was also a part of the debate among the Rishonim. Does it create a kinyan when, let's say, when the circumstances are in place, whatever those circumstances are, so does that actually transfer the property to whoever the intended recipients are? Or does it just create a obligation on the recipients? Some of the Rishonim and the Achronim, the Ksos and the Sivas, who spoke about this, so they considered the question of Havaras Nachala, the idea that there is a prohibition, the Gemara Bava Basra talks about, to subvert the inheritance rules of the Torah, which is one of the major discussions that comes up considering halachic wills. And some of them pointed out, so as the Sivas discussed this, that this is not considered a contradiction to the rules of inheritance, because Davka, because it doesn't automatically transfer the property, that the inheritance still happens, then there may be an obligation on the inheritor to carry out the will of the original owner, but that doesn't interfere with the inheritance happening. It just creates a new obligation. Since it doesn't automatically transfer the property, so this is happening in parallel to the inheritance, and that's just a extra obligation now directing the heir what to do, and therefore that's not considered interfering with the inheritance. So whether or not this could validate a will is a major discussion. So hashkafically, it may explain the legitimacy of a halachic will. So if one uses the halachic will, and again, we're not yet explaining, we won't be explaining tonight how a halachic will works, but taking for granted the functionality of a halachic will, and if we're just trying to understand why that's not contradictory to the intent of the Torah, so perhaps the mitzvah l'chaim divrei hameis can explain that hashkafically. But can it also explain it technically, or can it explain technically how a civil will could work? So that was a major machlokas. A major machlokas in general, whether civil wills are acceptable. And many poskim felt that they're not going to be effective, but there were poskim who felt that they were effective. So if they could be effective, why should that be? So there were some other explanations. Moshe Feinstein, for example, felt that there was possible validity to civil wills. But there were some who specifically did consider a mitzvah l'chaim divrei hameis as a possible avenue. So prominently among them was Rav Chaim Elzer Grudzinski, who wasn't 100% sure, but he did consider that to be a possibility in his Tshuvas Achiezer. He noted in his Tshuvas that apparently practicing to be, that the Bat Eidin were recognizing
secular wills, and he thought that maybe you could explain it that given that there was going to be enforcement of the will in secular court, and the decedent knew that there were going to be enforcement, so therefore that has the effect of escrow, that has the same reality as having putting it in the hands of a third person, and therefore that is going to count. Normally, the actual physical requirement of having put it in the hands of a third person is unlikely to have happened. That's why that requirement would generally mean that you're not going to have the standards for a civil will to be effective. But this chiddush here is that the civil enforcement, the government enforcement, is going to be enough, perhaps, to be equal to that. So that was something Reb Chaim Moser considered. And this was also considered in earlier generations also. The Mari Halevi considered this. Rav Aaron Intinga, in his Shuvas, he considered this and he rejected it because he thought that that would need, in order for it to be true, that would require the civil heirs to go to court to enforce it, and that, he said, would be against halacha, so how could you ever assume that's going to happen? So therefore, we shouldn't take that as a reality. But that was argued upon by the Minchas Shai, who claimed that the Mahariah conceded the point to him, and there was a whole discussion whether that was true or not. Rav Eliyashiv wrote a letter about that later, and he thought the matter was unresolved and maybe would depend on the Metzius, whether the heirs actually would take it to civil court in order to be enforced. So that was itself a discussion. Also, there was a tshuva in the Cheshev Ha'ifod of Rav Chanach Padua, who was a prominent British posek, and he said that in England, at least, the law is that if you have a civil will, so then the state has to appoint an executor. And he thought the executor is the shlish. The executor has that same role, so therefore that satisfies that standard of there being a shlish, and it could be effective for that reason. And yeah, it has the same reality, and it's going to have that same effect. So that was another possibility. And there were others of Herzog who wrote about wills a lot in his writings about contemporary practice of civil society, in his writings about the state of Israel in the early days of the state. He was the first chief rabbi after the state was established, the second chief rabbi after Reb Kook, but the first after the state was established, and he wrote extensively about how a modern state could function. So he wrote a lot about this. So he thought that the reality of Dina Malchus Adina is relevant because everyone, pretty much almost all poskim, rejected the idea that Dina de Malchus de Dina by itself validated the secular will. In fact, the Rishon already considered that and said that it's not true because it's against the Torah, and Dina de Malchus de Dina doesn't work against the Torah. There was one view that was quoted that said differently, but the vast majority of all poskim said outright that Dina de Malchus de Dina does not itself validate a secular will. But, Rav Herzog said, there's still a way to come to that conclusion through Dina Malchus Adina, because that may have the status of a shlish. Why? He says because he thought the requirements that the Rishonim have of a shlish is really because we just never know if somebody's serious or not. People could say a lot of things during their lifetime, especially if we're not talking about a deathbed situation like a Shuv Merah. A Shuv Merah, we're talking about a person specifically is in a very dire circumstance, and it's going to be canceled if he recovers from that circumstance. But if we're not requiring that, so we're just saying anybody who says something during his lifetime, I want to give my property to so-and-so, how are you ever going to know if he's serious? People say things all the time, and they change their mind all the time. So how are you ever going to know that that's actually self-daitam? So until they actually take a step and give that property to someone else and say, I want you to give this to that person, you can't know that this is actually self-daitam. You can't know that this is actually serious. But if they're going to take the step of writing a will, and they know that Dina Malchus Adina is going to enforce the will, so then that's an expression of seriousness as much as a shlish. So perhaps you could say that that is going to be effective for that reason, not because Dina Malchus validates the will against the lacha, but because that takes the role of the shlish, and maybe that's also going to be effective. So that's also something that was possibly considered to that extent. It was also in the earlier generations where Shmuel Salant had a letter, it was published later in the writings of Torah for Shmuel Salant, where he thought that the minhag in his time also, that the Bat Din he thought were validating secular wills, and he thought that that was appropriate because of Mitzvah L'Kayim Divrei HaMeis, and he seemed to have an understanding, which is a fascinating idea, that there is a moral weight to Mitzvah L'Kayim Divrei HaMeis that actually expresses itself as some kind of
continuing bialis over its property, which is a fascinating idea and really seems to be very mechudish, but you do find it in a number of achronim from his point and later, that mitzvah l'kayim divrei hameis means that even though when a person dies, he no longer owns his property, but there's still some impact, there's still some voice that the individual continues to maintain over his property. And there's a tshuva like that of Klausenberger Rebbe, Divrei Yasev, and also Rav Shmuel Rozovsky in his Chidush and Tegitin. The three of them all say something along those lines, Rav Shmuel Salantim, Rav Shmuel Rozovsky, and the Divrei Yatzeh, they all have something along those lines, that mitzvah l'kayim divrei hameis means that there continues to be some kind of control, some kind of influence that a person has over his property, at least until the Yorshin actually take it. That's what the Rav Shmuel Salant writes. There's a whole discussion in general, who has the status of muchzak, with property that is now in an estate. So does it mean that it's the muhsak of the halachic heirs? Is it are they the muhsakim because the halacha bestows it to them? Is the civil heir the muhsak because the law is going to allow them to take it? Or do we say that maybe there should be some muhsak as to whoever the original owner wanted it to go to? So there's a whole discussion, a very significant question of who is muhsak in this property, which is a significant discussion. So Shmuel Salant thought that this power that comes from Mitzvah L'Kayim Divrei Hameis is going to have a role. So that's also a fascinating idea that comes from this. There is a question also that if we do assume that there seems to be greater relevance here specifically to the children of the Mace, who exactly is subject to this instruction is somewhat of a discussion, but we find in most of the iterations that it seems to be addressed most pointedly to the children. There's a tshuva in the Minchas Elazar where he talks about a husband inheriting the property of his wife and whether he is bound because of her instructions in Mitzvah L'Kayim Divrei Hameis. Most of the time the discussions seem to center on the children. So is there a role here for Kibbud Av Eim? Does that impact on the obligation? Is that a part of it? So in general, that's an interesting question. Rabbi Akiva Eiger has a tshuva where he talks about the question in general about whether a child should have to listen to a parent's instructions about their property after they die because of Kibbud Av Eim. And that's a multiple part question because, first of all, let's say when a parent is alive, so if you have to listen to a parental instruction in general, outside of their service is a topic of discussion. But normally the rule is that if a parent asks the child to spend money, so there's machlokas in the Gemara, whether a child has to spend their own money for serving the parent, and that's called Mishel Ben, and we conclude that Mishel Av, that a child is obligated to serve a parent during their lifetime, but their expenses are charged to the father. It's Mishel Av. And even though there is an obligation of Kibbud Av Eim after they die, the Gemara says, but it takes on a different form. And the question is, so what if the parent had left an instruction on how their property should be spent? So strictly speaking, Rabbi Akiva Eiger acknowledges that the property was inherited by the child, so the child should, on the surface, not have an obligation to give out that property based on the parental instruction, because it's now their property, it's now the child's property, so it's Mishel Ben, and we don't say that the child is obligated to spend their money on Kibbud Av Eim. But he thought maybe it's different, that maybe we say you don't have an obligation, Mishel Ben, if the father, let's say in his lifetime, says, I want you to pay for my sandwich, get me a sandwich, the child has to do that, that's Kibbud Av, but normally the father has to pay for the sandwich that the child has to pick up. But, and we don't say that the child has to dip into his pocket to pay for it. But in this case, he's not dipping into his pocket. The money came from the father to begin with. He wouldn't have this money if it wasn't for the father. So yes, technically, it's his property. But does it make a difference that he only has it because of the father? He only has it because he's inheriting it from the father. So Rabbi Akiva Eiger wasn't sure. He thought maybe it does make a difference. Maybe we wouldn't call that Mishel Ben. Maybe we should call that Mishel Av. And maybe we should say that there should be some binding nature to the father's instruction. So he wasn't sure, but there were others who thought that maybe there was something to be said about that. So the same Mariad, Marian Tingo, who didn't necessarily validate Mitzvah L'Kayim Divrei Hameis as the force for a civil will, but he did think there was something to be said for that. Or at a minimum, and the Marsham has a truth about this also, it's certainly a kiyum in Kibbud Av Eim, that if a child chooses to do this, so he may not be obligated, but it's certainly a kiyum in Kibbud Av Eim. There was a lot of literature about this because
The Sadiger Rebbe left the will, and there was a whole question because whether the will has validity in light of the fact that it contradicted the inheritance rules of the Torah. So there was a lot of literature. The Mariyad and the Marsham and many others wrote tshuvas about this, long tshuvas. Marsham was a very long tshuva talking about this question about whether the will was valid. The assumption was that he knew what he was doing with Sadiger Rebbe, but how do you explain that? So there was a lot of literature about Mitzvah Kandir Rameis and Kibbut Aveim and all of that in light of all of these rules. So there were other Chassidish rabbis who also left wills, and there was a lot of literature trying to figure out how exactly to address that. So that was a big part of it. And so they assume that whether there's a chiyuv kibud aveim is arguable, maybe yes, maybe no. Or Silberstein has a piece about this. Maybe there was also grounds to say that that's not considered Michel Ben. We say coming from the father's estate, maybe that's different. That's not like saying you're dipping into your pocket, but this is coming mikoach av, and maybe that should be looked at a little bit differently. But certainly as a kiyum, that there is going to be a fulfillment of the mitzvah of kibud av v'em, and there could be a moral value that would go along with that, and that is something to consider. And there was an interesting debate about this that between some British rabbanim, we mentioned before, of Chanuch Padua. So he argued on another British rav, Yochum Schlesinger, who took the attitude that said civil wills are completely nothing, completely no good, and that if a civil heir, if the heir who's named in the civil will would take the property, they would be gazlanim, they would be stealing because the halacha doesn't recognize it. And he said that even if the halachic heirs would be mochel, so it would still not be valid because it's mechila v'talos. They would be not understanding that there is no validity to this will and it's a mistake in mechila, so therefore it would still be stealing, it would still be completely invalid. And Rav Padua said he doesn't think that's true. He doesn't think that's mechila v'talos, because they may not know the halacha, but their mechila would be based on the idea that they think this is what the father wanted, and they're acting to try to be consistent with the father's wishes. And there's some truth to that. There's some halachic recognition that there's validity to that, that there's a kibud av v'em that is there, so it's not a mistake. It's not something that the halacha would deny completely, and therefore he thinks that if they took that attitude, that wouldn't be a mechila b'tal. So he's not so sure that that would be such a mistake. So there's a lot to figure out. Halacha l'maiska, the posim certainly advocate the utilization of halachic wills, because that is the certainly the surest route to dot all the I's and cross all the T's and bring about both halachic propriety and family harmony, and to address things the most proper way. But when that doesn't take place, so then there's a significant discussion about what is the most appropriate path, both halachically and morally, and there's a lot to figure out. But this concept of mitzvah l'kayim divrei emes, again, many understood that there was a moral value that is embedded in that, whether or not it has actual halachic enforceability, whether or not it's a kinyan, under what circumstances would it be a kinyan or would it be a chiyuv, that is a subject of major debate. But the assumption that it reflects a basic moral reality, as the Joel Lameshev wrote and as the Tashbetz wrote, Rav Asher Weiss has an essay about this in his Sefer Al Torah, where he makes that point as well. So there's a lot to consider in terms of what that reflects. And it's a very powerful concept that is a lot to explore. Okay, Yashar Koach.